So happy to have you listening in here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. I'm going to spend the next 45 minutes or so talking with you about one of the giants of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, Dr. James Crow, who, I guess it'd be hard to measure the impact. It was such a great impact that he had on the field of genetics. And also on his community and on his students and family and friends. He's a wonderful man. And I think sometimes we take for granted the work that some of our people do in public service and in particular in teaching institutions like at the University of Wisconsin. And once in a while, I think it's good to take a minute or two and sit back and reflect on the accomplishments of some individuals. And certainly, Dr. James Crow deserves that. And so I'm glad to talk with you about him today. Maybe you had a class from Dr. James Crow or knew about him. If you had a class from him, you probably still remember some of the jokes he told in class. But you might also have some other reflections or maybe just questions about him. Certainly invite you to join in. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. And also go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can do that as well. And we're visiting with two people today, Rayla Temin, who came to UW-Madison as a graduate student, received her Ph.D. in genetics with Professor Crow back in 1963. And following that, she was a research scientist in his lab for many years, and she joined the genetics faculty in 1978 and overall knew him as a mentor, friend, and colleague for 55 years. That's a long time. Rayla Temin, welcome, and thank you for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it very much.
It's a pleasure and a privilege to be here.
And with us as well, Barry Ganetsky, who joined the faculty at UW-Madison in 1979 after working and completing a Ph.D. in genetics at the University of Washington in Seattle and postdoctoral work at Caltech. And he's currently a professor of genetics, and he is the Steenbach Professor of Biological Sciences at UW as well. Barry Ganetsky, welcome, and thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
It's great. He was a great guy, and isn't it true? Sometimes I think we just don't realize the quality of so many of the people that we have serving us here in this state and at this university.
Well, someone especially like Jim. I mean, he was a national treasure.
Yeah. Well, let's talk. What was the focus of his work? And I think it kind of changed a little bit over the kind of his career. Rayla?
Yeah, well, his research was in the field of population genetics, and he used both experimental and theoretical approaches to this. For his experimental work, he used Drosophila, fruit flies, which have been a favorite model organism for genetic research since 1910. And for his theoretical work, he used mathematical and statistical methods to help understand dynamics going on in populations. And a main focus and interest of his work was on the genetic variation that exists in natural populations. How do we measure it? How do we describe it? How it's maintained? And how it affects and impacts on fitness, survival, and viability and fertility. And a major player in the variability is mutation, genetic changes in the DNA. And so a large body of work in the Drosophila lab was devoted to studying the types and the rates and the impacts of deleterious mutations, both those that are newly occurring and those that you find existing in natural populations. And there are techniques in Drosophila for revealing the hidden damage, essentially by inbreeding the flies. And then you can ask whether these mutations are in genes that have large effects, maybe cause death, or whether they're genes that have very small effects but act together cumulatively. And you can ask how long they persist in populations and whether they're completely hidden. And one of the big interests in the findings in the lab is that there are hardly ever any really truly hidden deleterious genes. They have maybe tiny effects, but altogether they can influence fitness. So that was a big part of his work. But in the course of this work, there were also some accidental findings that turned out to be very important. And this was in the tradition in Drosophila and other research where you treasure your exceptions. And one of these was a mutant gene that turned up that was a selfish gene called SD, standing for segregation disorder. And this was a gene that didn't play by Mendel's rules. It would promote its own transmission at the detriment of its partner gene. And a lot of genetic analysis was applied to this, and it has a lot of evolutionary ramifications, and there's been a lot of molecular work, thanks to Barry, who took up this research for his own PhD. Another of the accidental findings was a phenomenon called hybrid dysgenesis, which occurs when you make crosses between certain strains of Drosophila. And what happens with these only particular crosses is that then a lot of things just go berserk, and there are a lot of genetic abnormalities. And it turns out that in this hybridization process, there are some genetic elements mobilized that jump around. And this also then led to a great body of work. So these were just some of the many things that he worked on.
What kind of guy was he like, Barry?
He is a very difficult to capture everything he was in terms of his personality, but I think the word that describes him best, and the way I always think of him, is as a gentle man. I mean, a gentleman in every sense of the word, in how he behaved, how he interacted with colleagues, how he interacted with students, and just the way he was as a human being. And there's, in this business of science, there's a lot of people who are very famous, who are very smart, who are brilliant and do all kinds of outstanding things. There are a lot of people that you might respect in terms of their accomplishments, but you may not always admire them as human beings. Jim was somebody that I always looked up to, not only because of the outstanding science that he accomplished, but because he was the kind of person that you could look up to and say, that's the kind of person I would like to be if I were that good. And, you know, most people are not capable of doing that. But in every way, in how he handled himself, in how he interacted with everybody that I ever saw him interact with at any level, if you were not aware of everything he had accomplished and what his stature in the field was, if you were just somebody coming in the building, you would never know just from the way he
was. Like the guy next door.
He was just like the guy next door, and that's how he was. Folksy, down to earth, self-effacing, great sense of humor. He always, no matter how busy he was, and he was busy, he always made time to talk to you. When I was a new faculty member, my office was just two doors down from his. There were a lot of things I didn't understand about the business of teaching and being a faculty member, and he was right there, and I could just walk down, walk in his office, whatever he was doing, he would stop and talk to me. So, you know, you just can't say enough good things about him as a colleague, as a teacher, as a peer, and not just at the university level, at the national level, and at the community level. He did so much for so many people. His influence really transcended beyond science in terms of national policy and the things, as well known, his love for music, the things he did for the city of Madison with respect to the Madison Symphony and the Pro Arte Quartet.
Yeah,
we truly lost a treasure.
His research, he works with, he worked with Drosophila, as you were talking about, and some, you're sitting here thinking about it, you might say, well, what is the significance of all that work with those flies? What practical significance does that have in our life?
Can I have a stab at that one?
Yeah, sure, you can.
I mean, Rayla's done a really nice job of explaining Jim's interest in the genetic variation that exists in populations, the experimental work mostly done, as you said, on fruit flies, looking at genes of small effect, different mutations of small effect. And I think for a long time, there was a sense that much of this work, although it was enjoyable to the people who worked in the field, was somewhat arcane and may not have impact beyond the people who were interested in the nature of genetics of populations and evolution and things of that sort. It's taken on a whole new level of significance now with respect to human disease, because many human diseases, the common diseases, not the ones that are caused by single genes of major effect, like cystic fibrosis or Tay-Sachs disease, but common ailments, high blood pressure, diabetes, things of that sort, cardiac disease, are conditions in which the causative factors are many genes, each of small effect. Mm. And the kind of analysis that Jim and his colleagues and the rest of the field did to understand the population genetics of organisms like fruit flies turns out to be the same, exactly the same, as understanding the genetic basis of these diseases in humans. And if we want to understand the kind of genetic variation that exists in human populations, how to assess the impact of that genetic variation, the techniques have already been worked out in Drosophila.
By James. We will talk some more about Dr. Jim Crow. Stay with us. Many people are part of the University of Wisconsin community at some point in their lives, but not all leave an indelible mark. But certainly Dr. James Crow, who was not only a world-renowned geneticist, but also an excellent teacher, a passionate musician, fine human being. We're talking about him today. Larry Mueller here. Glad you could be with us today on the Ideas Network. My guests today are Arela Temin and Barry Gonetsky. Both had the opportunity to work alongside James Crow and are here to share their thoughts on his life and legacy. And I wonder if you knew James Crow. Did you have him? Were you a student of his? Were you fortunate enough to call him a friend? We'd love to hear from you as well. And questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. And we'll be back with our guests right after this look at the news. Stay with us. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, spending the next half hour or so talking with you about Dr. James Crow of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Recently passed away. He left a lasting legacy, not just as a giant in the field of genetics, but as a warm and wonderful individual. Certainly his presence is going to be missed. He was very active in the community and just an outstanding teacher as well. So we'll be talking with a couple of guests about him today. Rayla Temin, UW-Madison, came here as a grad student, received her Ph.D. in genetics, studied under Jim Crow in 1963. She was a research scientist in his lab for a long time, joined his the faculty in genetics in 78, and overall knew him as a colleague and mentor and friend for over 50 years. Barry Gonetsky joined the faculty in 1979, PhD in genetics from University of Washington and Seattle, and postdoc work at Caltech. And he's currently professor of genetics and Steenbach professor of biological sciences at the UW-Madison. So it's great to have them with us today to talk about Dr. Jim Crow. And you may have had a class from him, or you may have known him personally. You may have questions about him, or maybe you've got some stories to share. I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can even post on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show, and you can post a comment there. And Rayla Temin, we talked a little bit, Barry's talking a little bit about the sort of the practical significance of the research that he did. And I know you wanted to comment on that as well.
Yes, it's often true in research in the sciences that you start out doing research and thinking about something just because of your interest in them, your pure curiosity and wanting to know, and then those having, in the end, very practical results and ramifications, applications, such as Barry talked about. In addition, his thinking and the theory and the findings on the impact of mutation on populations were brought to bear on public issues. So, for example, after the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki at the end of World War II and the 1950s test explosions with the H-bomb and the radioactive fallout, the National Academy of Science formed committees to study the health effects of atomic radiation. And Dr. Crowe served on and then chaired the committees to consider the genetic or the mutational effects and to come up with risk estimates for populations exposed to radiation, even very, very low doses. And the reports that they prepared and their recommendations became the basis for setting radiation protection standards and for formulating national policy. So they were very influential, for example, including a ban on above-ground atomic bomb testing. This work was further than when Dr. Crowe chaired a National Academy of Science committee extending the work to the mutational effects of environmental chemicals. So these were very, very important societal contributions. And then, in addition, another area where population genetics and statistics comes to bear and is used a lot has to do with DNA technology in forensic science. And Dr. Crowe chaired a committee on that, a National Academy committee, and his work on that helped lead to the accepted use of these DNA tests in forensics in the courts. He also was a co-chair of a committee that was set up by the National Institute of Justice, where they met with judges and prosecutors and defense counsels to explain DNA and to tell why it was so useful and so reliable for these tests. So he made those contributions in the area of health effects on to humans.
So that very significant. And he was very good at explaining. He was a tremendous teacher. We had an email from Kay in Waterford who said, I had the privilege of having Dr. Crowe as a professor for genetics 501 in the mid-1970s. He was an absolute great professor. The course was tough, the hard course, but he did a great job of trying to make it understandable, and he had such a wonderful demeanor and a wonderful sense of humor that comes from Kay in Waterford. And Barry, I'm sure both of you can comment on that, but Barry, maybe first.
About Jim as a teacher? Well, you know, I think he just had this incredible rapport with students. In how he presented material, sometimes perhaps almost he made it seem deceptively easy, because he could present it in a way, and he, as with everything he did, in such a graceful manner that one might think that, yes, I really understand it. Seems very simple. It seemed very simple when he was up there explaining it. I mean, I had this experience because before I took over the course, I sat in on his lectures because I wanted to see how he did it. And it all seemed so easy when he explained it. And then you'd go home afterwards, and it wasn't always quite so simple. But you know, one of the things that most impressed me, I've never forgotten it. I've now taught that course myself for over 30 years, and I've never forgotten it. I looked at the course evaluations he received, and I think in this sense, it really says something about him, and I think it is absolutely unique in my experience. There were this undergraduate genetics course is tough. It requires a lot of hard thinking, a lot of problem solving. A lot of students have difficulty in the course. In Jim's course evaluations, it wasn't that all the students loved the course. They still said the course was hard. They complained about the course, but they loved the professor. And that is very unusual. You know, when I teach the course, in my experience, if they don't like the course, if the course is difficult, that translates into not liking me either. But with Jim, there was no way you could not like him because he was never confrontational. He never put on airs. He talked to students in the same way he talked to everybody else. That sort of folksy, down-home manner with a good sense of humor. And I think students, as everybody, just immediately gravitates towards him. You can't be in his presence and not sort of feel this admiration and this attraction to him just because of the way he was. I just read recently one of the students had written something about him. Actually, it was somebody who went on to be his graduate student, but he commented about his experience when he took the course with Jim as an undergraduate. And he went in to complain about something that an answer that he thought was graded unfairly. It was graded incorrect, and he thought unfairly so. So he went to complain to Jim. And Jim was insistent about, you know, not changing this and why he graded it as wrong. But he did it in such a way, in such a cheerful way, that the student left, still had the thing wrong, but he left thanking Jim. He said it's sort of like thanking a traffic cop who's just giving you a speeding ticket. But that's just how he was.
that's a great story. Rayla, you have some, I bet have some stories as well.
Well, I had the opportunity to witness and experience and benefit from his teaching, both as a student in his population genetics course when I was a grad student with him, and then I TA'd in his general genetics course, and then I was a student in his lab. And he was basically a teacher and educator at heart, and his enthusiasm for his subject was just infectious. He made you want to learn it, and he could take any topic and make you think that this was something that was really very fun, very important to learn, and he inspired you. So he was very well prepared. He was very organized in his lectures, and he made them seem effortless, as Barry described. But you could tell that he really enjoyed his teaching. His lectures were laced with historical anecdotes, and he could distill these very complex concepts. He would always say that this was intuitively obvious, and he put an equation on the board, and he said, well, you could cancel this out, and it comes down to this, and then you could approximate here, and then we get this beautiful equation that sings. Only a musician could say that. And then you just could see the essence and the beauty of what he pulled out. He also liked to keep his lectures up to date, and that made them very interesting. The other things he did in his classroom, which so many of his students then followed in their own teaching, which I did because afterwards I taught the Genetics 160 course for 29 years, is he took photos of the students, even in the large lectures. He would have them line up in groups and write their names on a big sheet of paper that they held under their chin, and he would do mug shots, and then he would cut out the pictures and paste them in his grade books. Everything was done by hand at the time, and so if a student asked him a question or came up after, he would associate the name with the face, and he would get the students to think he knew all of their names. In addition to the classroom teaching, he was really an educator at large. He has a legacy as a great teacher in all spheres, even outside of that big genetics course. In his writing, his books have been very influential. For his courses, he published, starting in 1950, 8 editions of his lecture notes. The first edition, which came out in 1950, and several subsequent were spiral-bound notebooks in which the printing was on the left side and the right-hand side was left blank, so that students could pay attention to the lecture and then write down any extra bits of material. And as time went on and the field just burgeoned with new knowledge that he included in his revision, starting, I think, with the fifth. He had to print on both sides. He also wrote a very major population genetics book with his colleague Moto Kimura, who had been a graduate student of his and then became world famous on his own. Crow and Kimura's book in 1970, An Introduction to Population Genetics Theory, laid much of the groundwork for the mathematical basis for population genetics theory and influenced many people who never had a chance to work or study with him directly. He also wrote these very wonderful reviews of his thinking, his theoretical work, and his experimental work that brought together so many different things. He was just an expert at summarizing and distilling and synthesizing the state of knowledge, and then he disseminated this work. And he also was greatly sought after as a speaker, and because of his being a great raconteur and just a brilliant scholar. And finally, after he retired in 1986, he continued to contribute to the field by his own papers on theoretical issues that he was interested in. But he co-edited with Bill Dove, a faculty member at Wisconsin, on a series of essays on the historical and anecdotal records of things that had happened in genetics starting back in the 1900s. And these were called perspectives. And right now, until now, there have been almost 300 of them, and Jim himself wrote 43. And they're known for their clarity and lucidity, and they're just the most wonderful pieces to read that reflect on the history of genetics, which he traced really in his own career. So he was an educator in all of these different domains.
It's amazing. And a musician. Mm-hmm. We haven't talked much about that, but he had a great love of music, too.
Yes, he was very balanced in his life, both in his scholarly work, his intellectual academic work, and then his outside work in the community and the music. And then within the academic field, he also balanced between teaching and research, and he was an expert at both, and he did a lot of administrative work at the university too, contributing in that way.
And frankly, in a lot of cases, when you have somebody of his stature in a research, as a researcher, the amount of teaching, is particularly to undergraduates, can be much less. But he certainly did not shy away from teaching.
In fact, it's very hard these days to find somebody who is doing as much as he does, not only administratively at the university, at the national level, and still be that engaged with undergraduates. If we have time, there's a couple things Rayla mentioned about Crow's notes that reminded me of a couple of stories.
And
about
that's what they were called, too. Yeah. Everybody called them Crow's
Notes.
It
was called, the title was Genetics Notes, but it soon became known as Crow's Notes. That's how everybody knows it. Published in, it must be at least a half a dozen different languages. So two things immediately come to mind. When I first started teaching the course, I used Crow's Notes as a supplement to the textbook. And I soon discovered that I had to stop doing that. And it wasn't because Crow's Notes, there was anything wrong with it. It was that they were too good. But in a sense, they were the summary of his lectures. It was sort of like a Cliff's Notes version of genetics. And I discovered that if I gave this as supplementary reading, no student would read the textbook. They would only read Crow's Notes. And as good as it was, I wanted them to read the other. And I discovered there's no way I could tell them, please read the textbook too. So I'd have to just stop using Crow's Notes. I kept using it to help me, shape my own lectures. But it was dangerous to expose the students to them. And I also watched Jim. That's when my office was just down the hall from his. I watched him while he was doing one of the revisions. And I think what this illustrates is Jim's amazing ability as a writer. Effortless as with everything else, I would walk past his office and he was sitting there at the keyboard typing away, just typing away. And I said, what are you doing? I'm writing a revision of the notes. And he was doing this with less apparent effort than it takes me to write an email letter to somebody. He was just typing away as fast as he could go. And this also relates to his involvement with the perspectives, the 50 or so of his own reviews that he contributed to the total of 300 that were written. Often these were done when an author who had been commissioned to write some review had reneged and didn't turn in the article they were supposed to write. And in the matter of a day or two, he would just knock one of these articles off. And if you read the collection of reviews he wrote, it would seem that he knew every person, whoever made any important contribution to genetics from about 1900 on, knew funny stories about them, was able to, put it into the context of something else. And he would just write these articles and get them done within the matter of a day or two. And as somebody pointed out, probably much to the chagrin of whichever authors, that they didn't have enough time to complete the article. I mean, he just did, and everything he did was like that. And I think it's a testament to just how remarkable he was, that he could do all these things. That's the only way he could have accomplished as much as he did, because he could do everything with this apparent ease. Everything came apparently easily to him. And one other trait is something that I've thought about for many, many years watching him in action. I think it was an important lesson. He knew when to be perfect, and he knew when certain things were not necessary to make absolutely perfect. He was willing to
live. An example of that.
Well, I mean, he knew when something was good enough. He would not worry over minor details. So maybe if he had to give, often he would have to give a lecture with very little advance notice. I saw him do that. Somebody would just say, could you fill in and give this lecture? I know if it had been me, I'd say, I can't do it because I need to make the lecture. I have to do that. And he would just say, sure, he could give the lecture. And he would go give the lecture. And maybe it wasn't absolutely perfect in every detail. Maybe something wasn't quite as smooth as he wanted it to be. But he didn't worry about that, because for him, first of all, for him, the 90%, rather than being 100% perfect, was already way more accomplished than most mere mortals. But even for himself, he learned to accept that if he wanted to do as many things as he did and do them as well as he did, he couldn't be perfect at everything. Oh, I'll give you another example. This is in relationship to the concerts he would give to the department, and I can say more about that later, but just a quote. So when he started giving these concerts, and he started at about age 90 on his birthday as a gift to the department, because he said he had received all the gifts he would ever need in life, he introduced, when he was giving these concerts, he had a quote from Samuel Johnson about a dog that walks on two legs. And this was in relationship, because he was always self-effacing, in relationship to the music he was about to play. And as Samuel Johnson said about the dog that walked on two legs, he said it wasn't so much that he did it remarkably well. It was that he could do it at all.
Well, you can tell from this that Jim had a tremendous sense of fun and joy, and that was the atmosphere he created in his lab when I was a student. Very high standards, but yet try to enjoy yourself while you're doing it. And one of the very first stories that I heard about Jim when I started out was one that melded both his science and his music in his life. And this was something that he told about himself, a joke played on him that happened when he was a graduate student at the University of Texas. And he was playing his viola in the orchestra. And one afternoon prior to a concert, he left his viola in the lab while he stepped out to get something before the concert. And unbeknownst to him, one of his co-students anesthetized hundreds or even thousands of fruit flies. The number got larger with each telling of the story. And he poured these anesthetized fruit flies into the body of the viola. And it was timed so that Jim didn't know that they were in there.
And they started
coming out.
And he
carried the viola to the concert. And as he started to play, and there was maybe a viola solo, the flies started to wake up and buzz out and emerge from the F-holes as he was playing. And he said that was the most diabolically clever joke ever perpetrated by anybody.
And on that note, I think we have to close. It's a great way to close. He was a great man, and Raylan Berry, thank you so much for telling us about him. He will be definitely missed. Thank you so much.
It's a privilege to be here.
Yeah, thank you.
Raylan Temin and Barry Ganetsky of the University of Wisconsin, friends and colleagues of Professor James Crow, and he definitely will be missed. Thank you for listening. Scott Craven joins us tomorrow here on the Ideas Network. Stay with us.